So, welcome. This is the part of the Science Network we call the Science Reader, where we do conversations with people who've written books. Recently, we're at Warwick's in La Jolla, and we're with Casey Cole, who is a distinguished journalist, an old friend. We go back some years, and also a professor of journalism at the USC Annenberg School, and she's just written a book called Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens, about Frank Oppenheimer and the world he made up. You've been asked this before, but we might as well do it.
Sure.
Something Incredibly Wonderful Happens.
Is not my title, so I have to say that right away.
Typical.
But what it refers to is the fact that most scientific research is pointless, and a lot of what most people do if they're really discovering something is kind of aimless wandering, which is something we've lost. Most of it is junk, which you throw out, but occasionally something incredibly wonderful happens. So that was the context in which it was taken, which is a pretty good one, because I think one of the things we'd really lost that Frank took very seriously was the ability to play, especially as adults.
Yeah. One of the things that he said that you then replicated, and the same experience, is that it's actually hard to communicate your excitement and delight at having experienced something, so that you then, in your excitement, go and grab somebody and want them to go through the same experience with you, and it's not the same for you the second time around,
yeah.
And you can't communicate it to them,
yeah.
Which almost seems like it's antithetical to the whole notion of a science museum and an exploratorium and so on. How do we get around that problem?
Well, you had to start with a really hard question. And that was actually one of Murray Gell-Mann's objections. The physicist wrote the foreword to the book. When he went to the exploratorium, he wanted a tour.
Yeah.
And Frank wouldn't give him a tour because he said, you have to wander on your own. So, yeah, the joy of discovering something through playing, really, through wandering around. It's something that you find yourself. Frank tells a story of how, when he was young, he loved to climb mountains. He liked to take these excursions, and he would go up and he'd find a little place where fairy slippers grew, or he'd find a little hidden stream, or he'd find a little cave, and then he'd come to the top and he'd look at this view, and it would be wonderful. And then he'd go back and he'd want to bring his friends up, but they would be tired, or they wouldn't be as good hikers as he would, and they wouldn't get to discover the fairy slippers or the little stream or the cave. And they'd get to the view, and it would be great, but they'd never want to do it again on their own, because they'd never experienced that joy of wandering and discovery on your own, which is difficult. It takes a lot of tolerance for chaos.
Yeah, but I'm thinking also about the difficulty you have in actual science education, which is such a huge problem
mm-hmm.
right now. I mean, I'm actually clutching an issue of Science here from a very recent issue of Science, and it's got a paper in it called Foundations for a New Science of Learning, and one of the authors is Terry Sinofsky, who runs the Computational
right.
Neurobiology Lab at Salk and is a chair of the advisory board of the Science Network, and we're very much involved in this whole notion of the science of learning that the National Science Foundation has,
right.
The Science of Learning Centers. And the certain things you can get at from a scientific perspective,
mm-hmm.
you can look at the temporal dynamics of learning and so on, but just the whole science education thing, you know, the bit from Natalie Angier's book where she talks about, and Peter Gallister, you have these wonderful little bright, shiny objects called children that are full of enthusiasm, and you sort of beat them into submission as they go through science education so that they're bored at the end of the whole thing.
Yeah.
How do you keep the enthusiasm going, you see?
Well, this is part of the problems. I actually told that story about Frank and the wandering about at my first faculty meeting at USC where they were talking about learning-centered education. I said, if you're really learning-centered, you have to get rid of grades and evaluation. Because what's happened is we're so geared toward only teaching what you can measure. I mean, that's basically what's happened to science education. And you can't measure that intuitive, that joy. And so the teachers are forced, whether they want to or not, to teach things that you can measure. So this thing that you and I know is key to enjoying science. Can I tell a little story about this that I just
sure.
love to tell because it really came home to me? I did an article for the New Yorker magazine about physicist who studied neutrino oscillations, these little evanescent particles that transform from one state to another, and I could not understand the physics of it. That's why I wanted to do it, because it was really difficult. It's one particle that behaves like two waves that interfere with each other, so it makes no sense at all. I somehow went back 20 years to the Exploratorium where I played with coupled pendulums, and I realized it's a coupled pendulum, that's what it is. So if you had asked me when I'd come out of the museum if I learned anything from playing with pendulums, I would have said no. If you'd given me a test, I would have flunked it. But 20 or maybe more years later, when I had to figure out how to explain something, that intuition, that's what saved me, because I had that base. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a interesting passage at the beginning of the book. There's a lovely lyrical introduction here where you're talking about going into this giant hangar with full of strange hums and flickers that give the place an ethereal, otherworldly feel, with a big yellow tent on your left, and so on and so forth. And you talk about you dropped a quarter into a donation barrel, jumped back as 300,000 volts of purple lightning from a Tesla coil zapped up a tall pole, and then you did it again. You walked into a swirling wash of color where the fine webs of sensuous red and blue and yellow created huge sheets of undulating light forms. Very tall man was twirling mylar lassos in the light, spinning swirls of colors. And, you know, I went to this passage from Francis Bacon, written in his book The New Atlantis in 1626, where he talks about in the House of Saloman having perspective houses where we make demonstration of all lights and radiations and of all colors and of things uncolored and transparent. We can represent unto you all several colors, not in rainbows, as it were, in gems and prisms, but of themselves single. We represent all multiplications of light and so on and so forth. This is actually taken from a talk that Richard Gregory gave to the mm-hmm. Pontifical Academy. Richard Gregory, of course, was in England, one of the followers of Frank Oppenheimer, who started his own exploratorium, as it were.
Yes, he was very useful.
Exploratory.
Yeah.
So this whole notion of the wonder of science, and Bacon, as you remember, talked about the merchants of light.
Uh-huh.
This goes back a long way, and for Oppenheimer to have sort of grasped on this struck me as a wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful resonance.
Back to the Future. I read about that in one of Richard Gregory's books, which I think is Odd Perceptions,
yeah.
It's called,
right.
Where he describes this thing that Francis Bacon said, we really ought to have. And I thought, gee, that's the Exploratorium. We actually have it.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's that. I think we've probably got schooled out of it. I have the sense that we were going to talk about Frank's upbringing a little bit mm-hmm. and what changed. But one thing that amazed me was, so you have this man, younger brother of Robert, the father of the atomic bomb. They're both raised father helped found the Ethical Culture Society in New York and the Museum of Modern Art. So they're very interested in the benefit of mankind and culture and music and art and so forth. And I think that was kind of, there was a class of people, there was a group of people who were like that, science, art, philosophy, it was all of a piece. And then after the war, Frank complained about going back into physics and saying that it had really changed, it was no longer philosophical, it was about ambition and getting credit and stuff. And I really never paid much attention until I talked to a couple of science historians who studied this period, who said it really did shift big time after the war, where science suddenly got about technology and all this wonder and beauty and connection with the arts. I mean, obviously it happened before that because Snow was writing about it, et cetera. But in physics, there was a big...
Yeah, but that's 1959. I mean,
yeah.
So let's hit the obvious dates here. Today is August the 10th. Yesterday was August the 9th, which is Nagasaki. August the 6th was Hiroshima. Frank was born on August the 14th, as it mm-hmm. happened. So all these August dates were a mm-hmm. constellation. But plainly, having been involved in the bomb,
yeah.
Was a huge influence on him. I mean, and certainly in the introduction, I think Murray said his horror at the dropping of nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was one of the seeds from which the Exploratorium grew. And then he said at heart, or somehow it was, the introduction says, at heart, Frank built the Exploratorium as a political institution. Its ultimate goal was to get people so addicted to understanding.
That's right.
So,
yeah, well, you know, they were caught up in this war machine, and whether we needed the atomic bomb, it was a different time and place. People thought Hitler was building one, so everybody was caught up in it. A lot of the physicists working on the project were pacifists. Frank was one, Robert Wilson was another. So suddenly there's this a test, this horrifying, your descriptions are just really, really horrifying of what it seemed like, the end of the world, a lot of the physicists said who were there. Just really horrific, the little bomb. So it's there, and then it's dropped on civilians, which most of the physicists there had no say in whatsoever and felt quite betrayed. So you spent your life growing up to be an ethical person, to be interested in the arts, etc. You build an atomic bomb, it's dropped on a bunch of civilians, and now what? So Frank was very aware of this idea that you can't just do that and dump it on the world and walk away. You know, you have to somehow give people the tools they need to deal with this. And his answer was, when people are afraid and feel that they can't understand anything, they give up, basically. They become apathetic, they stop being involved. If you can give people that taste that they could understand it if they wanted to, or somebody could, and that it's possible and you can be involved. You know, he often said that this so-called apathetic public wouldn't be apathetic if they weren't, he said, fooled and lied to all the time, which I thought was one good point. But to give people that confidence that they could do something, they could understand it well enough to do something. And this is where he really differed with Robert, with his older brother, who really wanted to go through the corridors of power and the heads of state, and he really thought that he could make a difference that way. And Frank never believed that. He thought you really had to go to the people and give the people the knowledge and the power and the feeling that they could actually do something.
So a couple of weeks ago here, I talked with Chris Mooney,
mm-hmm.
and he and Cheryl Kirschenbaum have a new book out called
right.
Unscientific America.
It's a very good book.
We're speaking to the same point.
We are.
Here,
mm-hmm.
In a sense that there is this sort of notion that a job of education needs to be done by scientists. And people sometimes see that as a rather hubristic on the part of the scientists. How does one achieve this sort of appropriate balance here? Let me put it another way. If the president says he wants to restore science to its rightful place,
right.
Where is the rightful place? What is the rightful place?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's at the center of culture. This was one of the arguments that Frank made. We are naturally, we want to know how things work, where things came from, why are we here, where do we fit into the universe, what is life, all of these questions that are natural, human, cultural questions, they're some of the very same questions that artists ask. They're very fundamental, why, how, where, you know, what kinds of questions. That is really where science is and what it belongs. It's just, not just, it's a very special way of finding out what's true, a very special way of knowing that doesn't tell us anything about some subjects,
yeah,
but it tells us a lot about some.
You know that if you asked scientists that question, they would say, we don't do why questions, we do how questions.
Well, you know, I've really seen this evolve so much.
Well,
I remember being at a lecture where somebody asked something about what came before the Big Bang or why the Big Bang happened. And it was this Vicky Weisskopf, a great physicist, and he said, we don't do those kinds of questions. Well, now, of course, that's a very common question that people actually are doing. So I think some of the why questions get pushed back. You know, until we get more and more fundamental. Well, how did life begin? But then why did life? I mean, it keeps getting, does that make sense? The boundary keeps getting put as we know more. Well, why did that happen? Well, why did that happen? And then it becomes a how question.
Right. Go back to Frank's, mm-hmm. go back to the, tell a little bit about the background here. to begin with. I mean, as I read your book, I mean, the biography, and as I read the books about Julius Robert, that was a privileged upbringing. That was a pretty smart family, collected great art and so on and so forth, and private tours of museums and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and very isolated too because of the fear of germs. And that was one of the things that really motivated Frank too. He remembered being really afraid as a child of infections. This is before antibiotics. Mm-hmm. And that you could get a cut, you could die from that. And one of his tutors actually did. And this constantly being afraid about how that affected people. You know, Lucretius, a lot of people have written about this, how fear makes people crazy. So if you can somehow alleviate fear. So anyway, he did grow up in this very privileged, isolated household, schooled in ethical culture, and then came the 30s, and he
got... Communist flirtation.
He did join the Communist Party. His wife, Jackie, was already part of it there. The main turning point, interestingly, was the fact that the Pasadena public pool was drained. The blacks were allowed to swim on Wednesdays, and they drained the pool, and then everybody else could go on Thursday, something like that. And the communists were the only ones who were actually tackling racism. So they did join, but immediately Frank thought it was ridiculous because, for one thing, they wanted him to take an alias. So he took Folsom, the name of the prison. That's kind of a joke. If you look in the FBI files, it's all Frank Folsom. I mean, they took it quite seriously. So that was disillusioned. But then, you know, then a funny thing happened the way. Then the war happened. So all of this political stuff went by the wayside because civilization, as we knew it, seemed to be in danger from Hitler and Franco, and people were afraid. So Frank was very involved in the work on the atomic bomb. And when it was over, he was glad to get back to physics. And he was doing experiments, catching cosmic rays, and trying to figure out what these mysterious particles raining down from the sky were actually made of. And he was quite happy, but the FBI had been trailing him since the 30s. And so when the clampdown came on left-wingers, it really affected him. Well, you know, he wound up getting exiled and winding up on a ranch in Colorado, partly because of that. 1 year, they were in the party for 1 year. And he made the mistake of lying about it in fear. And it's kind of a long story in the book, but basically a newspaper reporter wrote a big story about he and his brother that was full of lies. Unfortunately, it had one true thing in it, was that he had been a communist. Obviously, the reporter had gotten a hold of the FBI files because he knew things that Frank didn't know, like his membership numbers and things like that. But in kind of a panic, Frank just said, no, it's all untrue, it's all untrue. And so that lie actually came back to haunt him. But
it's interesting how these trajectories go, mm-hmm. though. One thing that struck me as very interesting was the way in which he actually ended up becoming a teacher, a science teacher in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
And was a brilliant teacher,
yeah.
and started lots of the techniques that would eventually find their way to the, mm-hmm. became the Exploratorium. The things that exhibits in the Exploratorium,
yeah.
and so on, the mood and the looseness,
right.
of the thing. Science teaching is a tough profession because, as you said, you need people expect results. It's a measurable outcomes and so on and so forth. And the notion of being allowed to just wander and explore is difficult. But
well, I think Frank was a teacher from very early times. He said he was the one who taught everybody in the neighborhood how to ride a bike and how to do all kinds of things. So he was always teaching. And I found a fascinating letter from his science teacher at the Ethical Culture School saying that even when he was a kid in high school, that he was a great tutor and teacher. But a lot of it was just his passion and enthusiasm. And he loved tinker. So if Frank were here right now, you know, he'd be picking up things and throwing them and, you know, just everything was, so you go into a museum with him or go anywhere where it said, do not touch. And, you know, he'd just take it apart, whatever it was. But his curiosity was off the, you know, off the leash. I mean, he was just so unfiltered that you were drawn into his wake whether you wanted to or not.
Well, it sounds as though that could have been fun part of the time, and
Exhausting.
Exhausting the other half of the time. I mean, so this curious bundle. We're all collections of attributes, but here's somebody who's his brother seems like he was the smooth one, the cerebral one. Mm-hmm. Frank is the kind of rough one with the kind of crazy big lollipy dog and all that sort of stuff and so on. But he's wearing a shirt and tie. Although he uses the tie to wipe the chalk off the blackboard.
and tie a trailer.
And tie was, a trailer yeah, right. and so on. So it's this curious combination of traits that it was just a... So when did... Recall when you met him. I mean...
So I was actually already a writer. I was writing about politics and education for a fairly wide range of magazines. And so, I mean, I was very young. I was just starting out. But I was with the Saturday Review. Some of you may actually remember this
Cousin.
Magazine, Norman Cousins. Right. Yeah, they moved to
San Francisco. Now, there's another link, because, of course, Norman Cousins was responsible for bringing the maidens back from Hiroshima for the surgery and so on.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was sent on an assignment to write about this crazy guy who'd started this crazy place. And I had no idea about anything about science. I had no interest. I thought it was irrelevant, difficult, just kind of pointless, and certainly not beautiful, and certainly not philosophical, and certainly not political. And I walk into this amazing place, and here's how dumb I was. Frank had an exhibit there about accelerators, he said, meaning particle accelerators. And I remember asking, I don't even know if I had the nerve to ask him, but thinking, why would you have a whole exhibit about gas pedals, you know, cars? I mean, that's really kind of dumb. But the way he talked about science as sightseeing, as the philosophical, sentimental, emotional payoffs of it, of the beauty of it, of the play of it, I just fell in love. I just decided that's what I wanted to do, and that's what I wanted to learn. And he was one of those people who actually made me believe I could long before I actually did. But he had that way of imbuing confidence in people, partly, you know, as a teacher, because he took you where you were. Because you didn't know the language or the jargon or even facts, he never treated you as stupid. He never treated his audience, no matter how little they might know, as ignorant or unteachable. He just as unexposed. So that somebody would treat you with the utmost respect, even though you knew absolutely nothing about what they were talking about, starting where you started, was a remarkable thing. So he opened a door that otherwise would have been completely shut. And he did that for, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, of course.
So you ended up working at the Exploratorium for a period?
Sort of, yeah. He hired me kind of against my will, because I thought, I don't know anything. And I started writing signs and writing little explanatory booklets. And in the process, I learned physics. And one of the funny things about writing this book was that, first of all, I didn't want to be in it at all. And I didn't want it to be a biography, because I didn't know how to write biography. But a friend of mine who was a historian got me onto the finding aid at the Bancroft Library online, which has a lot of scientific collections. And there is a folder of Hans Bethe, a very famous physicist. And then on the other side, George Gamow, another letters to Frank. And in between are three folders of letters from Casey Cole. And I thought, wow. So I went to look at that. And it was basically a history of this naive young woman learning physics for the first time and going, what? You know, I don't believe that. Or, wow, that is so amazing. Or arguing with him or complaining about how hard it was, but that whole history was in that letter, in those letters at the Bancroft. So it was really quite something to go back and be able to see how that happened.
He was actually a non-trivial physicist. I mean, he was involved in the projects and so on. It was just the banishment that really set him off onto a different track, right?
Exactly, because he could not. Yeah, he was unable to do physics. Yeah, he wasn't allowed to travel. He wasn't the FBI. They wouldn't give him a passport. And the FBI said to him, actually, Frank was the kind of guy, he actually made friends with his FBI tail because he just liked people. I mean, if they were, he just liked everybody pretty much. But so they told him pretty straight out that unless he named names, that he could not get a job in physics. So he told the truth, and his wife told the truth about themselves in the HUAC hearings, but they would not talk about anybody else. And so for that, he was exiled, for not talking about other people.
But here's again that curious paradox. At some point, he also didn't say that he was a member of the Communist Party. So that was
Yeah, and he laughed about it. I mean, he said he'd just given this big talk about how terrible lying and dishonesty was, and then he went and he...
lied.
He lied. But, you know, at that point, physicists were really under attack. I mean, yes. Plus his brother was under attack. The physics community in general was under attack because they knew stuff, and they weren't going along with the H-bomb thing. They wanted to... They, meaning Robert Oppenheimer, meaning the Secretary of State. I mean, Sir, the Acheson Report, there was an opportunity at that time to internationalize atomic energy of all forms, bombs too, because there were no interests, nobody had, you know, factories building atomic bombs, nobody had anything, that the physicists really thought a chance to have no more war, that this could be the end of war because we'd made this horrible weapon. And they were talking about, some of them, world government. I mean, Einstein was on the far radical pacifist side, but most of them were talking a lot about ways to internationalize this to achieve peace. And so, of course, the military really hated that. So the physicists were all under attack. He had a reason to be afraid at that point.
I mean, this is not just historical. I mean, the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists is still out there.
Yeah.
They still move the clock. The president is obviously paying a huge amount of attention to this at this point. This is still a major issue.
Well, and so was the silencing of scientists now we have a new administration, but under the Bush administration, the silencing of scientists for not agreeing and for not having the right opinion was also very, very prevalent. I mean, Obama is a little bit new to figure out what's going to happen. But yeah, there's no threat that's more clear and present than the nuclear threat. I think almost any physicist would... Well, I think most people who are really aware, because, you know, the Bush administration talked about weapons of mass destruction as if a biological weapon and a chemical weapon and nuclear weapon are the same. There's no other weapon that can vaporize a city and suburbs in a second. And we have tens of thousands of them on ready alert, aimed where? At the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union doesn't even exist anymore. At the former Soviet Union, and they at us on ready, on instant alert today, now. So, I mean, this is a very serious threat, which is why Frank talked about how radical the solutions were, that you couldn't, the old kind of solutions we used to use were not going to work. I mean, you really had to rethink what it meant, what was worth fighting for, what was worth having a war for studying how can we figure out ways people can get along. How can we figure out what are our really fundamental differences and similarities so that we can... And then crazy ideas like Jell-O drops, you know, was one of them. He mentioned it was a child's idea, but he thought it was a great idea, and so did I, actually. I mean, in theory, that if you have bad guys like the Taliban, say, let's say everybody would agree that there are people who have to be stopped. So what are you going to do without killing a lot of civilians? So, well, drop, you know, Jell-O on them, and everybody's paralyzed. They have something to eat. They can't do any harm. But he spent a lot of time, I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous, but he spent a lot of time thinking about what we could do, about things like bribery, like instead of dropping bombs, use advertising to bribe people into doing what, use persuasion rather than coercion. That we really needed to rethink how we conduct everything, politics, education, because we're in a new world. We can destroy ourselves. So we have to learn how to think differently.
Now, you teach, you teach science journalism?
Yeah.
But
also science and society, yeah.
Right, but do you deal with these issues? Are your students more interested, are they interested in these issues, or are they more interested in being able to write about something Darwinian?
They're very interested because they really have no idea of the place of science in culture, in everything. Science in court, science in everything. But In regards to this specific question about nuclear weapons and national security, which we do talk about a lot, I always show them John Elsa's film, The Day After Trinity.
Right.
You know, it's really a wonderful documentary. And they just come out of it just kind of stumbling almost, because they had no idea what an atomic weapon is, what has happened to them, and they're a little bit scared, which is not a good idea, because, you know, I used to ask Frank, why didn't you guys just scare everybody about the danger of atomic weapons? And he said, it doesn't do any good to make people scared. It just makes them paralyzed. You have to make them angry, which I thought was a good point. But they really do want to know. I mean, they don't know what to do with the information once they have it.
Mm.
But they really do want to know. It's not something they've ever encountered before. When do people in school learn about nuclear weapons and what they can do and how many there are and what they don't?
Well, until this recent initiative, it's largely gone away in the sense that what people, the environment has taken over, global warming, blah, blah, blah.
Well, you know, I've forgotten, I have to look at the book, but there is it's from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which is one of the great sources I used, but it's something during the Bush administration, we were spending 10, 12 times as much money, I think it was, on developing new nuclear weapons as we were on trying to secure the loose ones that are all over the former Soviet Union and in other parts of the world, that all the money was taken away from safeguarding what was already out there and put into developing new ones. I mean, there is such a thing as a military-industrial complex. There really is. These people are, you know, very powerful and persuasive, so.
You talk in here about, or Frank, wanting people to become learning addicts.
Mm-hmm.
So what did you learn writing the book?
I guess I learned how I became a learning addict. Maybe I was before, but not afraid of science. I mean, it's true. You give people that feeling of that joy of discovery on their own and the fact that they can do it. I bet everybody's had that experience where you do something you didn't think you could do, or you suddenly understand something that you didn't get, that was very hard, and all of a sudden you get it, and you go, wow, if I can do this, maybe I can do this other thing. I remember saying to Frank that if I could learn physics and I could learn to play the flute, which he made me believe I could, which I couldn't, but he made me believe it. I said, well, maybe I could learn to paint. And he said, no, painting is hard. But he did have that. He really, and I found myself doing things, and everybody at the Exploratorium, you see them doing things like somebody who knows nothing about it will start to try to fix a typewriter, do something. They don't know anything about it, but that's just a feeling. Well, you know, maybe if I give a look at this, maybe if I think about it, maybe I could come up with something.
Well, it's that sense, isn't it? You actually had a sentence where you said you found it hard to get over the feeling of playing hooky or getting away with something.
Yeah.
It was this sort of unsupervised joy.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think most science writers, this is a dirty little secret, actually feel that way, too. I mean, I'm not at the LA Times anymore because they don't hardly cover science anymore. It's part of the decline of newspapers. But when we were free to do it, you know, you're a kid in a candy store. You actually get paid to go out and find out cool stuff. And if it's too difficult to understand, it doesn't matter, because you just ask them, would you please explain that again? Would you explain that again? No, I still don't understand. And you get paid to do that. And so it is just, it was pretty amazing that that's actually considered learning. I mean, kids used to play hooky to go to the Exploratorium from school. They used to go there to get high. I mean, it was a center for kids and teenagers to go play.
Okay, so explain this to me, because it's still a little bit confusing to me, that plainly science is hugely important. Mm-hmm. Plainly, if you get an audience and give them some science, they enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
So why, I was at the Santa Fe Institute a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. Talking to Murray Gell-Mann, in fact, and a bunch of other people. I ran into Sandy Blakesley,
mm-hmm.
who's a colleague of yours,
right.
And she was making the same point. Why the erosion of science pages in newspapers, the decline of science journalism, the reduction of the number of people doing science journalism is amazing. at a time when you'd think that you'd need more of it.
Yeah.
And I raised this point with Chris Mooney as well. What happens? Is everybody going into blogging now? I mean, what's...
Well, you know, this is driven by economics and, you know, in the first place. We were talking about this earlier today, that newspapers used to have more of a civic responsibility to them before they were all corporate-owned, and now it's the stock price that runs everything. So media in general has experienced, which Chris talks about very well in his book, has experienced a general dumbing down, and science has been a part of that. But part of the problem, too, is that, you know, people are afraid of science. The editors, I mean, not the readers, but the editors tend to be afraid of it. They don't like to be confused. They think they can somehow sell a product that's watered down for as much as they could the real thing. I mean, obviously, it's an economic disaster. I mean, you can see what's happened to publishing in general. It's been a disaster, but it's because the economic model didn't hold up anymore in this market. And then the internet has something to do with it also, of course.
Yeah, but if you take people who are moved by you have a chapter in here called The Sentimental Fruits of Science, in which mm-hmm. you talk about some of the things that Frank thought were the benefits of doing the exploratorium and communicating science the way he did, or allowed people mm-hmm. to discover things. Then you get these followers, if you like, or because I'm working on the science of educating and so on, here's somebody I'm very interested in, a man called James Heckman.
Oh, yeah.
Independently of having read your book. Jim Heckman is a Nobel laureate in economics. And if you look at his Nobel Prize speech, he says, and I hadn't known this before, that Frank Oppenheimer was a decisive influence on my intellectual development. I learned the beauty of experimental science, the pleasure of matching theory to evidence. Although I later abandoned physics for economics, my enthusiasm for scientific empirical work, guided by theory, was born in his classroom. Now, if you look at the papers that Heckman has been writing recently, because I'm giving these to people all over. These are from the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This is an economist. And his papers have titles like Economic, Neurobiological, and Behavioral Perspectives on Building America's Future Workforce, The Economics, Technology, and Neuroscience of Human Capability Formation. So here's somebody who knows you can't do just one thing. You have to involve the neuroscience. Yeah. You have to involve the... And we're talking about human capability formation. These are big ideas, big concepts.
I didn't know that. I would be very interested in seeing those. I thought Jim Heckman was one of the most... There were a million of them, but interesting stories in writing this book. I got an email from some guy. I wasn't very good on email, so I didn't know who he was. Sounded a little illiterate almost. He said, oh, yeah, I knew Frank Oppenheimer, and he was at University of Chicago, and so we had dinner. This was James Heckman, the Nobel laureate. As I Googled him, I found out. So he's talking about Frank, like yesterday he knew him, and he still had his lab book, and he listened to music that Frank listened to, and he read books, Max Otto's Science and the Moral Life. And I said, so when was the last time you saw Frank? And he said, I was 17. He was 17 years old, a high school student. And that's the kind of effect that Frank had on a lot of people, just because of his passion and the fact that he would not let go unless he knew that you really, really understood something. He just wouldn't leave you alone. These kids in Pagosa Springs where he was teaching, this was his little town where he went to be a cattle rancher, knowing nothing about cattle or even what hay was.
Evidently, from the book.
Knew nothing in the opening. So he has these kids who are almost completely untutored, who are interested in sports, basically, and ranching. And he manages to turn a lot of them just into completely different people because of his personal passion, really, and his love of everything. And tinkering. Look at this. If you're around someone who's always going, look at this. Did you try this? Have you done that? You can't help but pick it up. I think.
Yeah. The trouble is that I think it's in a couple of weeks from now that Rafe Asquith is in town. Rafe Asquith wrote a book called Teach Like Your Hair is on Fire. He has this whole group of students that he turns into a little Shakespeare company. And they're amazing kids. Mm-hmm. They really love Shakespeare. This is using Shakespeare to convey, to get the passion of learning going, as the way Frank was using science. But is that all revolve around these iconic teachers? Isn't there some way of generalizing this sort of thing, isn't there?
Well, you know, Frank built this place. It was kind of a physical manifestation of everything that was inside his head. His brain turned inside out in a way, and all his experiences. So there are people at the, and it's not just the Exploratorium. There are other people, Kelsey, who's made similar institutions. But I've met people who never knew Frank, who are third generation, the new director of the Exploratorium, for example. But they get it. They've somehow gotten it through reading what he wrote, from being at the plays, from playing with it. I mean, you can pass these things along. You have to create other addicts. You have to create other people like me, for example. I mean, you know, he turned me into a crazy, you know, messianic, let me tell you about this because it's fascinating person. And I hope that some of my students are now driving their friends crazy, doing the same thing. Let me show you how. Can I drop a book and a piece of paper and show you about gravity and inertia? But I will.
You can
how
do
to find
it.
The center of gravity of your glasses? Whatever.
So you became a convert, right? So when you're teaching, when you're conveying this sort of stuff to your students, is there some overarching message that you try and get across, or was that pretty much it? The passion that you, is there some technique that you?
Well, part of it is, you know, is Frank's major message, it's Obama, it's yes you can. I mean, in a way, it's, this is not, science is not rocket science. It's absolutely understandable. Just because you've taken some courses that were difficult or turned you off, that's not necessarily what science is. It's something different, and you can learn it, but you can learn anything if you really want to. There are ways to get in there. They're mostly bad teachers, but I had the same experience really playing the flute too. I mean, in the years when I actually thought I could.
Oh, he did persuade you to try it.
He did. Oh yeah, I played for years without knowing that I was terrible.
But he had all these great teachers, expensive teachers. I mean,
He did. He was a very good flute player, but he imbued the confidence that I could do it, so I could do it. And the way he did it was the same way he did with physics. Was not starting with, you know, inclined planes and dropping balls and vectors and all that, but starting with the big idea, like, why are we here? What does it all mean? That kind of question. So in the flute, he started me with Bach, not Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. So when you really feel, oh, wow, this is beautiful, I want to know how to do this because it's so beautiful. It was the same with physics. The ideas were so beautiful. I wanted to learn. I always thought that about calculus. You know, they teach calculus in school without ever telling you what it is or what it's for. And most university-level calculus math teachers I know say they wish the kids did not take AP calculus. And because all they learn is manipulation, and they never learned the beauty and the why. You know, why did it have to be invented? Why do you need calculus?
Yeah.
So those wonderful ideas that lead up to them, people don't get, but they are accessible. This store is just, I'll bet you, I always tell my students this, they don't believe me, but it's true, and the faculty too. I can give you a list of, and you could too, maybe 6 to 10 books that I'm sure are here that anybody could read that would make you pretty, you know, literate, up to the level of most even scientists outside their fields, in all the sciences, in math and, you know, biology, genetics, physics, you name it, just from really good popular literature. Some of it's new, some of it's 100 years old, but it's there.
The line that I liked that is a sort of repeated theme in here, which seems to exemplify Frank's teaching methodology, was no one flunks a museum.
Yeah.
So it's like not like you can go in there and fail. It's just you're coming out with something.
Well, you know, a lot of the reason so many people followed Frank was he said these things that seemed so obvious when you think about, no one flunks a museum. And one of the things he wrote about when he was teaching at the University of Colorado was a screed about, why ever give anybody an F for anything? I mean, if somebody takes a course and doesn't do well in it, why put a brand on them that says failure? Mm. Why not just let them take it again? All you're doing is discouraging people from trying something that may be too difficult for them. So the wonderful thing about a museum is that you could fool around and that nobody was going to test you, but by extrapolation, why isn't school like that? Why shouldn't you be allowed to fail? And that's one thing we really have lost, is an appreciation for how important it is to allow failure and allow mistakes, because that's, you know, risk-taking. That's how you... If you're being graded and evaluated every single second of everything you're doing, all you can do is just follow in front of you. And I think if anybody who teaches sees this is mostly the problem we have with our students. They've been taught how to take tests. They've been taught how to follow rules. They've had to pass this hoop and that hoop and that hoop and that hoop to get to the next step. And they've really forgotten how to just think for themselves and associate and play and be creative. And it's, you know, it's difficult for them to do that. It's very, very hard.
Chris obviously talked, their book is a response to the fact that this is the 50th anniversary year of Snow's Two Cultures lecture.
That's right.
If anybody remembers what that was. But that dichotomy, false though it might be, mm-hmm. arts and sciences, is that something you get into when you're teaching as well? Do you try and...
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely.
Situate science in a...
Well, you know, I run a series of art-science events, too, out of Santa Monica. It was after our friend Bob Miller, the artist, who said the worst disease afflicting humankind is hardening of the categories. So this is called Categorically Not. And we bring artists and scientists and people together. But they really inform each other. And I think that's really important. We did one recently that pleased me so much because we had a topologist. Sandy Blakesley was there, actually. The subject was Inside Out. So this topologist was talking about things like, you know, Moebius strips and what insides and outsides. And then Sandy about neuroscience and your brain and your
brain
body.
Has a mind of its own.
And there were these actors, this wonderful troupe, who were talking about how they projected their inside to their outside in that relationship. And when it was done, this actor, him, said, I never knew that math had anything to do with acting. But people do see these connections. So, yeah, I make them all the... It's a very false dichotomy between the two. You know, Frank always said artists and scientists are the official noticers of society, people who notice things that other people either have never learned to see or learned to ignore. So they're very much doing the same thing, looking at things and going, you know, what's that and how can we look at it differently and how can I make you see what I see and making real discoveries about things too.
Yeah, I like this term that he used for the... I think this, the way that when the museum was opened, there wasn't an official opening or anything. There was not a big, it was just open.
Just open the door.
And there was somebody in there who would take you around, and this person was called an explainer.
They had one.
And they
high school
still
student.
Have explainers. I mean,
yes, the high school students. That's right.
So Baconian.
They're untutored, and they're, you know, they're inner city kids. A lot of them. It's a mix from all over the place, and they are immediately put in the service of explaining. And one of the reasons Frank wanted to do that was that even you could have explainers who were adult and who already knew stuff and who could probably give more accurate information, but they would not have that thrill of, wow, I just found this out, let me tell it to you, that the teenagers have. So even if they get it wrong, it doesn't really matter, because that's really not the point. The point is that thrill of discovering something and figuring out and then telling somebody else, hey, look at this. That's the thing, you walk into the exploratory and people go, hey, you're total strangers talking to each other. Hey, have you tried this? Look at this. No, you have to look at it that way. And that was what he didn't even put up signs to the bathroom in the beginning, because he wanted people to talk to each other. And he figured if you put up a restroom sign, then people won't have to ask, do you know where the restroom is? So really anything to start people conversing that way.
And then something incredibly
wonderful happens. That's right.
Casey Cole, thanks very much.
Thank you.